morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you're logging in from, if you're watching us live. My name is Glenn Mulcahy, your host for Love of the Game Virtual Summits podcast and now our new live stream series. And I'm super excited to be chatting with Allison Forsyth. She's one of the co-founders of ITP Sport, been a business leader specializing in safe sport prevention case management for a long time, and she's also a two-time Olympian representing Canada in alpine skiing, been in the high performance system, and for the last few years has been working diligently to improve our safe sport model, which I'm an advocate for. Looking forward to this conversation, and thanks for joining us, Allison, making time out of your busy schedule.
Of course, thank you for having me.
So I'll start off all of my chats I've been doing for the last couple of years with just getting a sense of, we're for the love of the game, and it's all about the free play as well as learning that whole love and passion for sports. So tell us a little bit about where you grew up and what did you play as a kid?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm an alpine skier, downhill skiing, we would call it in the industry. So I grew up on Vancouver Island in British Columbia. And so there's one mountain on the island that has a ski resort. So that's where we skied. I'm the youngest of three kids. So I was the baby. And so by the time I came along, I was on skis before I was out of diapers. So I don't remember learning how to ski like most people don't remember learning how to walk. So when people always used to ask me if I was scared when I'd have to go fast, I said, well, I progressed from the time I was two. So speed just became part of the deal. So I grew up skiing at Mount Washington. My sister went ski race till she was about 14. My brother made the national team. So he was the oldest of us. So growing up, all I wanted to do was be like him. You know, the things that motivate a child are to have the same uniform and to be like their older siblings. So so I progressed through sport from that point, made the national BC team, provincial team at about 15, national team at 17. So I was fortunate. One thing I had to do in sport though at that time, you know, back in the, we're talking mid 90s here, is actually leave my hometown of Nanaimo and move to Whistler when I was 14. So that was sort of when my parental supervision ended. And I was just, you know, trying to graduate high school on time because we were skiing and racing so much. So that's how it happened. And I had a pretty strong career at the end of it all. So I was grateful to grow up that way.
Was skiing the only thing that you did as growing up, or did you try any other sports, or was free play part of your experience?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. I do a lot of work now around that famous term now called over-specialization. I would say for me growing up in the generation I did, I only skied 2 days a week. So, but that was every weekend. So it did preclude me. I figure skated as a child. My mom was a professional figure skater. But I didn't get to do a lot of team sports because I could never do anything on the weekend besides ski. So besides school sports, which I loved, you know, track and field, soccer, volleyball, anything that the schools did, I definitely took a part of. But I would say by the time I was 10 or 11, I was full on skiing all the time.
How important is it, do you think, as you said, you're an advocate for against the world, but hopefully against the early specialization for kids to be participating? And I guess skiing be a different model because you said it's conflicting with team sports, but you did have an opportunity to play other sports in school. How important is it for kids to actually develop the athleticism to reach a high level because you went right to the Olympics?
Yeah, you know, ironically, it's not what we're really here to talk about today, but I also work in developing long-term athlete development programs. And I also do strength and conditioning and mental performance work with elite high-performance youth. So in that, I'll tell you directly what I see. I see a lot of athletes that come to me around the age of 13 or 14 and their bodies just biomechanically aren't working properly because they've been put through the same range of motion, really high impact. You're seeing lots of knee injuries at very young ages now. So what I will always say to parents or to coaches is, you know, if your goal is that your child's the best hockey player at 10, then that's, you know, that's your goal. And then you would probably do what you're going to do. But if you want your athlete to be a well-rounded human first and foremost, and then have an opportunity to play, you know, at a very, very high level of sport, you need to consider what else are they doing to counterbalance the biomechanics of that particular sport. So I do a lot of work with hockey players. I see a lot of, you know, knee problems, hip problems, just on the way that skate is gliding in continual pressure. So in general, I think just counterbalancing whatever sport your child is passionate about with other, whether it's a sport or other activities that help round it out is critical. And there's a reason why when we hit, you know, 13, 14, we do this silly thing called dry land. And so there's two things that I always wished as a child I had had. And I'll say this, obviously I'm always honest, you'll find out, but you know, I went to the highest levels in my sport, and I always wish I had done long distance running and gymnastics. So whenever we saw an athlete come onto the national team who had done gymnastics at a young age, not, I'm not talking about high performance gymnastics, but just learned the body awareness, that natural musculature and strength that you develop in gymnastics, it's incredible for fast twitch muscle fiber athletes. And then get your kid in cross country running, because you have a very limited time to develop an aerobic capacity in your child. You know, they say between 9 and 12 years old, it's critical. So I highly recommend to get into some long distance, you know, cross country running and gymnastics, I think are two really great sports for young people.
Yeah. And there's a lot of gymnasts, because that's the one sports early specialization. Then we'll go and jump into a whole bunch of other sports. And
yeah,
there's a lot of gymnastics groups. So fast forward to the teen years, you said you specialize and you're focusing on 10, 11, 12 years old. So going into your teen years, it was all on skiing.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. So the reality is, I mean, I used to joke, but it's true. I went to about 35 days of my senior year in grade 12. In skiing, we had to, by the time we were 14 or 15, we had to chase the snow around the world. So we were skiing in the summer overseas, in the Southern Hemisphere, and our trips became longer. So my hometown, which was a wonderful place to grow up, didn't have any specific sport programs. This is back in the day when we did correspondence with paper and mail. So everything has shifted a lot with this amazing e-learning modules available to athletes now, but I really didn't move as much for skiing as I moved for a high school ski program that was offered in the mountains in Pemberton. So I was committed to graduating high school on time, committed to going into post-secondary. So I had to move away from home to do that. But yes, from the time I was about 12 or 13 till 28.5, it was my life day in and day out with ski racing.
The Olympics, you had an opportunity to go to two of them. How special were they, and what was your favorite?
Yeah, it's a great question. And they were very different. So my first Olympics was 2002. As an athlete, what was interesting is I came into that Olympics after a breakthrough season, meaning I had climbed the ranks very quickly. So I came into that Olympics ranked third in the world, but with no Olympic experience. So some countries, in Vancouver did this before the games here. They'll send athletes ahead of time to sort of prepare. And I will say that would have probably helped me, because I went into those Olympics with huge expectations put on myself, first and foremost, and also feeling a lot of pressure from the country. And I came seventh. And to this day, I think it was a horrible result. I'm not gonna lie. So Olympics are podium or bust. Any athlete, well, my what I felt was podium or bust. I won't put that on any other Olympian. But for me, when I went in ranked third in the world, obviously I wanted to win or get a medal.
Yeah.
2006 was crazy. I actually crashed in the downhill event on the second day of the Olympics, the day after the opening ceremonies. I all but sort of tore my left leg off my body. And that crash in those Olympics ended my career. I didn't know it at the time, but I had to do about 5 major surgeries. And I tried for 2.5 years to come back to be able to compete in Vancouver, which obviously would have been a hometown Olympics for me and amazing. But I had to retire based on the Olympic injury of 2006. So that one was not as awesome. But those were my two Olympic experiences.
I kind of relate in a small way to your pain, because I was an avid skier as well as a whole bunch of other sports.
Mm-hmm.
Believe it or not, as a member of Ski Patrol, I was opening up the back run at Grouse Mountain Local Hill in Vancouver.
Yeah.
And slid down icy track for probably, I don't know, it seemed like an eternity. It was maybe 100 yards. I don't know. Tried to plant.
Yeah.
Top edge. And I did a full, like I obliterated my left knee.
Oof, yeah.
Required a full reconstruction, a year of rehab. Doctor that did the surgery said, yeah, you should be able to ski again. I'm like, confidence-wise, wasn't there. And then physically, I couldn't do the cuts. So it was like, right. Kind of like you, go hard or go home.
Yeah.
I never went to your level, but I can kind of relate to you some. So let's go into the late team and then your experience in the Olympics. I'll leave it up to you to share your story.
Sure.
What led you to where the path you're down now. So people that have followed you and know that in the challenges you face and now in light of recent events, I saw you on Turning Point, which has led me to reach out on the Chris Beach coming forward. So maybe tell us a little bit about your story and led you to form and do the work that you're doing now.
Yeah, for sure. So I work in an umbrella term we now call safe sport. And if anyone would take anything away from this, just remember, and my goal is that in 5 years, you know exactly what safe sport is, and you know exactly how your children are protected under the organization you're a part of with safe sport, or you are. So obviously the conversation I'll host right now for about, you know, five minutes here is about sexual abuse in sport. So just being mindful that that could be triggering for some people. So make sure you don't need to listen if it is, and I don't go into too many specifics, but just know that's what's about to happen here. So for me, I was a victim of serial sexual abuse in the Canadian sports system from the years of 1996 to 1998. What occurred was there was a very abusive coach that was hired onto the national ski team to coach underage junior females. And there was multiple victims of his. We were sexually abused both physically and mentally, coercively, by this man. He had sexually abused many, many young females before he was even brought as a coach onto the national team. I mentioned that because I hope I'll have a second here to talk to you about the changes that are being put in place to prevent this from happening again. But essentially, there was no controls in place and nothing that was ever done to sort of stop this predator from just moving through the ranks and moving around the country. So many of his victims, and if you're watching, I'm using air quotes on that because it depends how you define a victim, but many of his victims were from before the national team, a lot from Quebec. But essentially what occurred was mental and physical sexual abuse. When it was found out, I actually blew the whistle with the National Sport Organization. And we found out at that time he was sexually abusing 3 out of 10 young women on this ski team at the exact same time. The organization did nothing to stop it. They covered it up. They allowed him to resign. No investigation took place. And this man just went and walked out the door. So at that time for me, I had experienced a lot of trauma. The way that I would explain it, and I'll mention, if you Google Kyle Beach, I don't ever want to speak for Kyle, but I feel like his circumstance with the Chicago Blackhawks was quite similar to mine. Where I had a lot of trauma, obviously, as a victim of sexual abuse by this person, but I had equal, if not more, trauma, to be completely honest, for the subsequent 15 years that no one believed me, no one cared, and no one did anything to help me. And that was devastating to my mental health. I've had every mental health challenge you can imagine, from eating disorders to substance challenges, anxiety, depression. I lived with that. And what was really interesting, Glenn, is that I lived with that from the perspective of, I have people say to me, but Allison, you are successful. And I stop right there. And there's not many things that make me angry when I talk about what happened to me, but that makes me angry. And what makes me angry is I think that we have a big problem in our society if we think that is how we define success. That because I could carry on from a place of anger and shame and hurt and pain and disgust, and truly my driving force from that day until the day I retired was to prove my abuser wrong, because he had me mentally convinced that I would never make it without him in my life. That I think we need to check ourselves if we ever think that I was successful. So I've said it before and I'll say it again. I would give up every single medal I'd ever won. I would give up everything to have had this not happen to me. And so I think we need to remember that athletes are humans. We care. And these things happen. So that's what happened to me. I'll flash forward to just what occurred 17 years later. One of his victims, who was a wonderful, incredible hero named Geneviève Simard, she actually saw him coaching again, and he just sort of resurfaced. It's all the only way that I can describe it. She, up until that day, had never admitted to being one of his victims. And she went directly to, within the end of the day, she had gone directly to the RCMP dispatch in Mont-Tremblant, Quebec, a tiny little place. And she took her ski boots as a coach, because she's incredible. And she walked right in there and she said, this is a very, very bad man who's now back on the ski hill, and he has sexually abused multiple girls. So let's remember that for 17 years, many, many people knew this had happened. Many, many people chose to not do anything about it. And she had to do it as a victim. So within 12 hours, he was arrested. Many of us, including myself, victims of his, were called. We all were willing to tell our story. We were all just feeling so grateful that anyone cared. Many more victims that I had no idea were victims of his came forward. And we subsequently went through a 2-year arduous criminal trial. I had to testify the day after my baby was born. That was incredibly traumatizing in itself. And he was sentenced to 12 years in prison. So I'll stop there and just let everyone know that it's very challenging in Canada to get a criminal charge against a coach, let alone a criminal conviction. Particularly in sexual abuse cases, it's less than 1% of any sexual abuse case that results in a conviction. So was 12 years enough? No. And we were proud that we got anything, and we actually got a conviction in the case. The other thing I want to mention is that he has many more victims out there, and I hear you and I see you. The reality is that in a criminal case, you have to have a very high standard of proof to be able to even have a charge put against the person under your name. So I have a lot of empathy for some victims of his, or for any victim out there that feels they may have not had justice in their case. And so that's what's led me to do what I do now. So I work and advocate in the space of safe sport. Myself and my business partner, Elon Yampolsky, who has been working in safe sport longer than anyone in this country, upwards of 14 years in what he does. We teamed up and we have a full service consulting and prevention agency where we focus on prevention, awareness, education, me doing things like this. And I focus largely, I believe we should focus being largely on the most vulnerable sector in this space, which is, you know, youth. And unfortunately, the changes that have happened at the NSO level aren't applicable to youth. So we do everything possible that we can do to help prevent maltreatment in sport and to create a healthy, safe, positive sport environment. So that was long, but that's what I do and why I do it. So I have oodles of experience, both personally having lived it and breathed and lived what it is like to be an athlete in a high performance environment where we want the favor of the coach. We have a mindset to succeed. And that is why it is a breeding ground for abuse. And there's not nearly enough that has happened even now to date to stop it.
You had me a whole bunch of times there. Two parts of the story. From an athlete perspective, wanting to play or represent or reach a high level, the pressure that you are under and not being that whistleblower and coming forward, and or the parents. So, statistics I've seen is only 1/3 of people that are actually victims of some form of abuse actually do in fact come forward. Fortunately or unfortunately, because of what happened a few years back, the Safe Sports series, you said that you were piggybacking on, that the world is aware that it's not just common to e-sport. It was kind of like it blew up, literally. And, you know, if you look at USA Gymnastics and a whole bunch of other groups that it came to fruition, what is now happening versus what was 3 years ago or before that, that will make it not only safe to be in sport, but to ensure that the reporting mechanisms are there? Because the biggest criticism that myself and a lot of colleagues have had, there's never been an anonymous like 1-800 number for people to report to, and or it's reporting to the same organization that may or may not act on, which, you know, we saw recently with the NHL with the Blackhawks, and they stalled it for many, many years. So.
Yeah, exactly. So after our case, and I can't take credit for this because I sort of piggybacked on three original victims that came forward, and I jumped in with them as more that Anglophone of the group. And we had our publicity ban lifted, which means obviously in a criminal trial, maybe not obviously to everyone, but I know too much now, but in a criminal trial, you don't have your real name exposed. So we actually had to petition to the judge in order to be able to put our names down as victims of his. So we did that. And why we did that was because we wanted to be able to stand up and put our faces behind this issue and say, okay, Canadian sports system, and I'm only speaking, we can only impact the amateur sector, which is funded by Sport Canada. Okay, Canadian funded Sport Canada and amateur sector, why have you done nothing about this? Why did we all just sit back and watch this man go to jail and think that no changes had to happen to make sure this didn't happen again? So it's unfortunate that it was victims that had to do this, and also fortunate because as we saw with Kyle Beach, when you have a group of victims come forward and use their voice, people listen. So we worked directly with the then sport minister, a wonderful, wonderful advocate and woman named Honorable Kirsty Duncan. And she put in place three critical things that have taken 3.5 years to implement. Those are mandatory training and education for every member of an NSO, National Sporting Organization. Universal Code of Conduct, multi-sport, which is something I helped develop with the Canadian Center for Ethics in Sport. So that's a long but important 60-page document that needs to be signed onto. Anecdotally, within that document, for the first time ever, thanks to the brilliant work of Dr. Kerr out of University of Toronto, there's actual definitions around what psychological abuse is, harassment, bullying, neglect. I think it's important to notice that there's a lot of airtime put on sexual abuse in sport because it's obviously very egregious and it gets a lot of attention. But it's far more common in the work that we do to see psychological abuse, bullying, hazing, neglect, and harassment, and physical abuse. So there's about 9 different forms of maltreatment that are covered in that Universal Code of Conduct. So also know that if you're a victim or a coach or a parent right now, you have to be mindful and be very protective of all forms of maltreatment. The third thing that is now mandatory is a lot of the work that I do, which is independent third-party services. And I want to pause there to make people recognize that an independent investigation is not independent third-party services. So what independent third-party safety services are is that the organization does not intake the complaint. The complaint comes directly to an unbiased party. They triage the complaint. So in the world of me, the NSO would never have an opportunity to have covered it up. In the world of Kyle Beach, the Chicago Blackhawks would never have had an opportunity to cover up his abuse, because an independent third party would have taken in that complaint. Then that independent third party triggers an independent investigation. Those are 2 separate processes. So those are the changes in place. There is a helpline. And as you mentioned already, Glenn, it's a work in progress. The Sport Dispute Resolution Center of Canada is now has the mandate and the funding to put in place the independent safe sport mechanism for national sporting organizations. It's to be determined when that's going to be up and running. In the meantime, we work with many national sporting organizations and we work closely with the SDRCC because we want everyone to succeed in this space. But once that is up and running, what will happen is if you're a national team athlete and or a member of any national team, you will have a number to call that will go directly to someone who's not the organization. One other thing I want to mention, because I think it's important, is athletes don't report. And they don't report because of what happened to Kyle, what happened to me. They don't report because they fear retribution. They fear getting kicked off a team. They fear ostracization from their teammates, and they want to succeed, again, air quotes, so badly that they would rather live with arduous abuse than actually tell someone what has happened to them. So it is critical that we have a safe space and, like we're doing today, and having open conversations about what this is and why it is so critical that athletes feel safe and confident to be able to report. So I work in this space. Complaints are coming in more than ever because it's starting. Athletes are starting to come forward and recognize that what happened to them, whether it was 20 years ago or yesterday, is not okay. And so we need to shift the culture, all of us together, because the floodgates are opening. And from a public perception standpoint, it's going to look a lot worse before it looks better. So as these complaints are finally coming forward, as a parent, I do not want you to panic about putting your child in sport. I want you to educate yourself. I want you to find out what policies and codes of conduct your organization has. I want you to talk to your children about what it means to stay safe in sport. It's mental and emotional safety. It's as important as physical safety. And then we all need to get together and focus upstream on what it takes to actually prevent this cycle.
The prevention question is the one that we've all struggled with, is it preventable and how can it be? So I'm sure you've had a lot more higher level discussions than ones that I've had, particularly, and you touched on, there's various forms of harassment. So it's not just something as simple in a code of conduct as a coach. I want to shift gears to the coaching side. I'm saying at the beginning of the season, there's zero tolerance for any forms of harassment on our teams, without actually going into what those types of harassment can be. Mm-hmm. Because unfortunately, I've had the misfortune of being involved with a whole bunch of them on, the coming to fruition, say, hey, we can't do this. How do we get that education in lieu of, I know Sheldon Kennedy's done a pretty amazing job with Respect Group. What I was kind of dumbfounded with is that nobody at the professional level or higher level are required to take Respect Group from that education standpoint versus in the minor sports system, like in hockey, everybody has to take it, parents, coaches, even most other sports are having to take it now. So why not at the highest level in terms of that education? And is that something that's going to come to fruition?
Yeah, so from a national sporting organizational level, they do have to do something now. It can be the CAC, Canadian Association of Coaches, Safe Sport Training, which I helped develop. It's a free resource. It's excellent. Some organizations use Commit to Kids, which I don't think is great, but it's just for children. And Respect Group is great. Respect Group is an opportunity for an organization to buy into training and education, which I think is critical and important. And it's a wonderful service. From my perspective, education will always be more than an online training module. That's why I believe that there's a layer to all of this that's missing, which is the layer that I feel that I bring is the real conversation. And so when you mentioned like, what will it actually take to prevent abuse? That is it. And what I say that is it is that you as a coach need to know what it is. You need to know how you're protected under the policies and code of conduct. The days are gone when you should just breeze through your coach agreement or your athlete agreement and just sign. And you need to be so aware of what actually happens on the field of play. So when I do awareness with teenagers, one of the number one things I say is it is okay to feel like you want to be the coach's favorite. And it is okay to feel like you actually have a crush on your coach. And if I could tell you the reactions that I see, it's next level. That's the real conversation that we're in. That's why as coaches, you have an unbelievable responsibility, because you are dealing with young people who have brains that are still developing, that are hitting their pubescence, and they want to be your favorite. And that is normal. And so if you were to ask me what my biggest thing was when I was sexually abused and why I felt complicit in it, it was that. It was because I wanted to be his favorite, because I saw him favoriting other girls. And I thought that being his favorite would be what it took to be the best. Did I want to be sexually abused? Absolutely not. But that is where that slippery slope comes in play, where a predator will take advantage of that athlete's goals. And if you talk about psychological abuse, I have parents that actually will let their children be berated by a coach over and over if they believe that that coach will get them to the highest ranks of a sport. So we also have to check ourselves as parents. I know we want our children to be the best, but I will tell you first and foremost, I've been there. I've been the best. I was top 10 athlete in the world for my sport for 10 years. Ask my parents if they wish this had happened to me so that I could have achieved that, right? Like, that's the real conversation, and that's where we need to get to. We need to know that athletes will feel and think a certain way based on their mindset, and coaches also need to be protected. Coaches need to push for the proper education. And in Canada in 2021, there's an acceptable ways of coaching and there's unacceptable. I don't care what country you come from. I don't care what generation you grew up in. I don't care if someone says you're old school. If I hear anyone say to me, it's old school, or that's just the way enter sport is, it gets me fired up. It gets me fired up because that's not okay. And we have to check ourselves because we were all coached in a certain way too, right? We all sit here as coaches and or parents, we could say, well, my coach yelled at me forever and I turned out okay. Guess what? That might not have been okay for the person next to you, and maybe you're not okay, right? So there's a repetition of a cycle that happens based on how we were raised and how we were coached, how we were parented. And the statistics do not lie. There is massive trauma that's occurring. Look at concussions. We all know concussions are a bad thing now, and we have Rowan's Law and we have safety measures in place. We have baseline testing. So this is all we need to do on this side. I know it's a lot to ask, but it's not okay that someone got hit in the head for 15 years and now has mental deficiencies for their whole life. It's not okay that athletes are being abused and harassed and neglected and sexually coerced into whatever act. And it's just, we got to stop it. And so until we all realize that and we stop using excuses, like, but the rule of two is hard. Got it. Super clear. I get it. It's not easy. But we're not going to put a stop to this. It wasn't easy the first time that I had to wear a mouth guard for a concussion either. I hated the thing. But I did it as an athlete because I knew it would protect me from concussion, right?
Yeah, I mean, the jury's still kind of out on that mouth guard. Yeah. But that said, concussion is another one of those soft spots for me because I had two majors. Second one, I woke up in ICU. I had no recollection of the 2 weeks leading up to the concussion. and 3 months of rehab in a dark room in the old school days of recovery. Well, fortunately, that's changed, and the awareness and the education is there. I've had an opportunity to interview and talk to a few people in that space, and it is a brain trauma. It's not just the word concussion. I'm not a big fan of it. But it can have long-term effects, especially if you get a second one in the same season. That's when it really gets bad.
Absolutely.
You look at some, you know, a lot of players that have pulled out of sport, and then the concussion book and movie, the CTE, that it all is going to evolve. So that's another conversation itself.
Right. But one thing I'll say on that, Glenn, which I think is interesting, because I deal with this, you know, in sport, and what I've obviously deal in safe sport. And then I look at what's happening with brain traumas, and thank you for clarifying that for me. It's like, we have Rowan's Law here for hockey in Ontario. And I would challenge us all to actually know why we have that. Who was Rowan? Why did it happen? Why, you know, it's not okay. The days are gone where you just, oh, I have to sign this to roster my team. Okay. So if you're coaching a child team and you have to sign onto Rowan's Law, you also need to ask yourself what happens? What do I need to do as a trainer or a coach if a child hits their head? Because this is the next step that is, in my opinion, I'll only speak for safe sport. It's that next step that is critical, and it's missing still. People just sign the paper and they go, let's just move on. And I'm not saying this is everyone, but that's what I see time and time again, is we tick the boxes, we become compliant with our governing body, and we don't pause and just have that moral and ethical reflection on, okay, what actually do I have a personal responsibility to do to change the system and shift the culture, right?
Yeah, and Rowan's Law, I was actually in Ontario. I was speaking for the Coach Association Ontario live conference back in the day when we still did those. And I sat in on the presentation they were talking about it. And that was a sad story, because the girl that it happened to, she didn't report that she was suffering concussion-like symptoms, and then felt obligated to play in another game, and then sadly led to her losing her life as a result. So it is a big deal. And, you know, I've had coaches that ran, I don't know how many coach clinics last year. I did 16 and a whole bunch this year. We talk about concussions. Yep. Everybody goes, oh, so there's just more awareness about it now. I'm like, yeah, that's a good thing. Because if we didn't have the awareness, when I was playing football, if you got your bell rung, what did the trainer do? He just put smelling salts under your nose and like, well, really? Am I really good? So sidebar conversation on that front as well. So we could definitely go at length. What then, on the other forms of harassment that are coming into space, one of the big ones, and hopefully this is something that you're trying to figure out a way to nip it in the bud, because it comes up all the interaction I have with coaches. What can we do to pull or eliminate or push cyberbullying out of space? Because that's really become a big deal. And not just the physical and verbal that you see, but the cyberbullying is really starting to have some effects on sport. And what can we do to prevent that?
Yeah. So it's interesting. I mean, there's, there's many policies and codes of conduct out there that, as far as just communication in general, you know, you should not be a coach that is texting back and forth with an athlete. And I know how challenging that is, but this is where things are going to suck. I'll just say it, but we're doing what's best for society. Like, we get too used to just being in these individual conversations. Also know as a coach and as an athlete that, like, that is documentation, right? So you need to be careful that for anything to do with that, you need to be very mindful. But as far as cyberbullying goes, I think the biggest thing that I see, I actually was just a part of this interesting presentation that had nothing to do with safe sport. And I could tell acutely that the coach of this very high level young hockey team had some sort of negative experience, because he had a whole list of rules. There's no WhatsApp groups that you're allowed to be in with each other. So what he had done was, he had created his own playbook to be on his team around what the athletes were not allowed to be in together, and how they were not allowed to have conversations on social media. What he was seeing was bullying that was happening within WhatsApp groups, where, like, all the kids are over here and then the kids over there. And so it's just being, not just, there's no just in this conversation. I see it, it happens. And I do not feel that there's strong enough controls at any sort of government's level around it yet. So as a coach or an organization, you always have the opportunity to create your own rules around social media usage. And it's bullying happens so much easier in that space than it happens in real life. But you would ask yourself, okay, if I you know, if I had a group of kids over here that were yelling at a group of kids over here and racial slurs or homophobic slurs or whatever going back and forth, you would have no tolerance for that. So why do you let them have these chats on their phones, right? So I think it's a bit like a no tolerance policy for some of this for what's going on in these spaces. And the other thing that he had done, which I thought was excellent, is he did have, you know, a WhatsApp group chat for all the players, but he put two parents in it with them. So there's also like, you know, and that's, it's just like, hey man, like let's trade Tim Horton hockey cards, like got it. But I'm telling you, you put a parent in that group and the kids are not going to, you know, they're not going to act up. So you just have to control it.
Yeah. I mean, one of the big recommendations is that everybody on the team should be part of group function that you're using. You already touched on it too. Texting one-on-one has got to be treated the same way as a rule two in a dressing room or any closed door environment. Everybody says it's a dressing room, but in a closed door environment, it could be a car, it could be, you know, somewhere else, whatever the case may be. But many coaches don't think of texting as being one-on-one in a room. Well, you are, because nobody can see that.
Yep. And so that's why I've had teams, I understand, right? So you'll have a coach who needs to text an athlete something or wants to have a conversation about their play that day. You put another coach on the thread, you put the parent on the thread. Because if there's something that you want to tell that player that parent or other coach can't see, then you're not supposed to tell the player that. Yeah. Because it's not your business. The parent should know what's happening. And if it's not the parent, then the other coach should know what's happening. And yes, your phone, everyone's like, well, my phone. It's like, no. Like there's no, hey, even if it's a skill-based thing, right? Because it's such a slippery slope. And just as far as like the stages of grooming, I just want to mention, right? It's favoritism, isolation, favoritism, personal bond, isolation, and complicity. So it starts with favoritism. Then that predator finds a way to create a personal bond, whether through, I have a lot of text cases, like whether it's through that. And then they find a way to get into that athlete's life. Then they find a way to isolate them from other people, get them on their side. That's when the abuse occurs. And then they make them feel responsible. It is a recipe followed time and time again. So here's the thing. I've also dealt with circumstances in my personal life. I would never talk about an active case I have, but I've dealt with circumstances in my personal life where I have friends who are coaches and they've been put into difficult spots because they've unintentionally had too close of personal bonds or they've unintentionally favorited someone. So that's where, you know, we're as a coach, you also need to protect yourself. The rule of two in these things are put in place so that you can be protected and you would never be accused of anything that you didn't do. And it's just going to take that little bit more work. And once it becomes normal, we'll all be like, remember 20 years ago when that was allowed? That is crazy. Like I grew up in a generation of ski racing where I was 10 years old and I was taken on a road trip and slept in hotels with like 18-year-old coaches like that. Those days are gone. Thank God. But this is the new way it's happening is through digital, and it's not okay.
Now let's touch on the digital on the phones. Comes up every time I'm doing a clinic or a workshop. Well, coaches say, well, everybody's got a phone now. How do you prevent them from having them in the dresser? What's the word of wisdom coming from your side of this one with all the interaction you have? Because that bylaw, I believe, or that policy, probably 10 years ago that Hockey Canada implemented it. Yet there's still coaches that think nothing of their players having their phones in the dressing room. What's your thought on that?
Well, I mean, my thought are, if you want to protect yourself, don't do it. I mean, if you think that it's more important that your athletes can just be on their phones or be having conversations that aren't about your sport or whatever it is, then that's your team's not going to be as strong because you're not as focused, and B, you're asking for trouble. So as a coach, you might not like it, but you have to have a policy. You have to have something around it because you're trying to protect yourself. Are you kidding me? Like people can take pictures of other athletes getting changed. Like it's ridiculous. So I could go on a tangent about why it's absolutely the stupidest decision ever as a coach to let that happen. And I get it. I think I don't want to say it comes down to the conditioning that we had. There's a cultural conditioning. And when we haven't had a negative experience with something, like find one person in this world that had a naked picture of them sent out on the internet that thinks that it's a good thing to have phones in a dressing room. And I'm not saying what that's about, even just for focus. You have an activation, a deactivation, and a reactivation of athletes before they go on the ice or they go on the field to play. The deactivation, put on some music, let them goof off while they're getting dressed. They should be on Snapchat. They shouldn't be TikTok sharing. They shouldn't be, hey, check out this picture. It's ridiculous because you're trying to you're creating an environment that is just conducive to something bad happening.
Couldn't agree with you more. I'm glad I heard from another
we could go.
You said you go on a rant on that one. I'm like, oh yeah, I didn't know it was open Pandora's box up, but it is a big deal. And
same, it's a big deal.
Not just for the athletes.
Yeah.
The coaches should not be bringing a phone into the restaurant under any circumstance. So when I say lock it in your glove compartment or give that phone to the team manager, so you're dotting your I's and crossing your T's so that you're protected as a coach.
Yeah.
Because the last thing you want to have happen, and one of the things that I'm hearing over and over again is the allegations could be worse than the actual fact, because maybe it didn't happen, but something came forward. So if you've dotted your I's and you've done everything above board and you're fully transparent, everybody, then you're good. But if you, that slippery slope that comes into play, as you've alluded, it can open up a door that you don't want open.
Yeah, I mean, as far as, you know, and just from statistically speaking, when it comes to anything sexual, like the odds that something sexual is reported that isn't true is very low, just statistically speaking. Children specifically very rarely will say they were sexually touched or sexually abused if it was not accurate and not true. Doesn't matter. What I hear you're saying is that it's anything, right? It's anything that could possibly happen. And I mean, there is, you know, there's social media challenges with administrators and people of power. There's, you know, you just have to know that online means you're online. And back in the day, my gosh, I would have these friends that would be like I'm the generation when Facebook was first created, and we were all these famous athletes at the time, just like following each other on Facebook. And then all of a sudden it was just like this influx of like these, like, no offense, but these creepers that would just come in. And it was before the days of fan pages. There was no controls on Facebook. And the things that we were exposed to was crazy. So you also just have to recognize, I've had Olympian friends of mine where I've had to be like, you know, that picture of you doing that, really, like, think of how many very famous athletes have been busted through social media doing illegal activity, right? So your brand is your brand. You're a coach. You've got to be a coach. Your personal brand matters. Like, I got to be mindful of my Instagram. I have a public profile on there. I do safe sport work. Of course, I'm funny. I want to like banter sometimes with things I see that are funny online. But like, you got to hold yourself with the utmost respect and integrity through your online channels as your offline channels, because everybody is looking. This is unfortunately the world we're walking into now. And I think our generation, like those of us that are in our mid to late 40s and upwards of that, I worked in brand and marketing for years, so I know exactly what's happening in these spaces online, but we don't know that. And we have to know that our whole life is going to be seen. If we can't be a stand-up, I can't be a stand-up safe sport advocate and then go onto Facebook and post garbage, right? So we also have to be mindful that we need to hold ourselves to the integrity of what we do.
Yeah, and that's one of the recommendations I've given to coaches. Be aware, you're going to have your group social media, but if you personally are sharing something is, you know, going to be taken completely the wrong way, that could come back to bite. And I know some coaches have actually been let go because of their personal social media.
Interesting.
And it's like, you posted that.
My experience to date was more athletes where I was like, you know, you just went to the Olympics. And if you look at your Facebook you look at your Facebook from 4 years ago, someone's going to see that. And that picture of you on Mexico vacation should probably not be there anymore. So clean it up. There's a reason why before you go on The Bachelor, they make you like comb through your social media, you know?
Yeah, the downside, even though you deleted, it's still been posted and it still can be found, tweets, whatever the case would be.
Yeah.
So let's come back to ITP. And you now partner with a whole bunch of different organizations. We've said all of the NSOs. Who has been kind of the early adopter or the leader in wanting to roll out and implement and reach out to you for services? And what kind of bar are they setting for others to follow?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, you know, what we will always say is that the organizations that... you know, the NSOs that actually choose to do more than they're required. Let me just put it that way. So we offer what we call our Safe Sport Culture Audit, which is one of our most proactive tools that we believe an NSO should do, which is we come into the NSO or PSO or club. It's not obviously we do it at any level of sport. And we basically confidentially and anonymously interview a large part of the membership base. We do surveys. So we gather data as well as our insights and expertise, and we create a gap analysis from two perspectives. One is we tell the organization what risk we think they have based on the gap that exists in their Safe Sport programming. And the second, we clearly tell them, this is what you think you're doing to prevent and deal with maltreatment in sport. And this is what we're actually hearing is happening. That's critical, because that's where we find that gap most times. Most times we'll find a gap between policies and reality. And I will champion, we just finished one for water polo. We've done artistic swimming. We have Alpine Canada is doing an exceptional job with Safe Sport now. You know, you have to go above and beyond what Sport Canada tells you you have to do. I'm sorry, but like you have to, because we provide an incredible list of recommendations for them. They don't need to use us if they don't choose to, but time and time again, there is gaps between what they think is happening and what is happening. So any NSO or PSO or club that actually cares, I hate to say it, but like, I think you have to have that acute awareness. And what I'll share, Glenn, is it's, you don't want a Bertrand Charest to come through your system. You don't want a Larry Nassar. Look what happened to USA Gymnastics.
Yeah.
Right? Your whole sport is at risk. And ticking the box is not enough. Your whole sport is at risk. You have, you know, from insurance to the cost of investigations to even if you didn't, and I know everyone does, but even if you didn't care about the athletes, my gosh, do it to protect your organization. Right? And that's when everyone always says, well, they're just trying to protect themselves. No, we protect athletes to protect the organization, because you need to know what's actually happening and you need to do the right thing to fix it, or you are in trouble, big trouble. And if you show that you've done the right thing to fix it and a suit comes against you, that is a good thing. You can only do so much. Nobody can stand here and say, well, we're going to prevent this from ever happening for you. I can't say that. Yeah. Yeah, no one could, but I can tell you how to do it as much as you possibly can to prevent it.
I mean, it's a lot of it is the education, a lot of it's the awareness and implementing the checks and balances so that it ultimately doesn't happen. But I've had lots of conversation with a lot of people. You've had a much higher level conversation. Are we going to eliminate 100%? Probably not, but at least, and I think this was kind of the takeaway that I had when I was watching on Turning Point, it's what we do when we get wind of it. And how we handle it going forward. That's instead of sweeping it out of the rug, which was pretty commonplace 30 years ago, now the awareness is there. So kind of like some last key nuggets to share before we wrap up. What are some of the you can kind of mention the three things that are kind of bringing on board, but you've said there's a whole bunch of athletes are now coming forward that were victims of a past and victims now. How effective are the new checks and balances that we implemented going to be? Because if I heard you right, the 800 number for anonymous reporting is still a work in progress, or is it now actually live?
So it's live, but it does direct you back to the National Sporting Organization, because there is no independent mechanism put in place if you haven't chosen to use services that we have, or there's a few other groups that do what we do. Okay. So that helpline is great for people that are having challenges, want to talk to someone, and it is better than they would say the same thing. It's a work in progress as far as making it completely independent. What I will say is the check, it's been a long time coming, but I would challenge every organization with this one thought, coach, athlete, everyone. If you have Safe Sport programming and policies in place, does every single person in your organization know what they are and how they can help them and the people around them? If your answer to that is no, you have not done your job. Every day, I talk to athletes who have no idea what an independent third-party safety officer is, even though they have access to my services. So we have not done our job, and then we can use fancy words like implementation and adoption. Guys, communicate it. Talk to your athletes about it every year. A 30-minute Zoom call is all it takes to reinvigorate what Safe Sport is, why it matters. Here's the number to call if something happens. Here's the parents meeting. Here's the, I know it seems like a ton because organizations are so bogged down, but checking the boxes, and then you have the people that actually need the services not even knowing what it is, you have not done your job. And we're better than that, right? We're a country full of awesome athletes, awesome coaches, and awesome administrators. I firmly believe that it's not about the athletes versus the administration. They need to work together. We would not have administration and coaches if we didn't have athletes and vice versa. So athletes need to also take the personal responsibility and be like, hey, I heard this thing at this conference I was at called an independent third-party safety officer. It's a really weird word. I don't understand acronyms. Welcome to my world, having to learn those for 3 years. Like, don't even understand the acronyms. Find me, you know what I mean? And it's nothing against us. I didn't know anything. When I was an athlete, I was like this, right? If you had said the CAC to me, I would have been like, ooh, you sure not? You don't mean COC? Like, we just barely knew anything, right? So you've got to speak to the athletes in the way that is palatable for them. And you got to educate everybody on what is available. And if it's not available, then you make it happen.
Let me ask, why the tunnel vision, do you think? Is it because you're so focused on your immediate goal at hand? You want to reach this level, this level, this level, and you don't look at the big picture? Or is it because the coaches or just the environment itself? I'm just wondering.
So three things I would say, and this is off the top of my head. One is, you're right, just focused on the prize. The second thing is, we weren't educated. I had no training, education around safe sport, obviously, like nothing, I had no idea. And then the third thing and the most important thing is that when you know what this is like as a coach, it's like, let's get this stuff done with so we can just get back onto the field of play. So you come into an organization every year and you go, ugh, I have to sit down and do this like drug testing thing again. Then I have to go over here and pick up my uniform. Then I'm going to go over here and sign a 55-page athlete agreement that I don't know what anything means. And I just want to go out and ski, right? So what's missing in the sports system is enrollment. Like, why? You always, Simon Sinek, we can take so much from marketing. I'm telling you, Simon Sinek with brands, start with the why. Why does this matter? Don't just be like, here, Rowan's Law, sign it or your team won't get rostered. Here, Safe Sport Policy, sign it or you can't go on the next trip. Like, I've talked to athletes who were like, yeah, I did Safe Sport training or I wasn't allowed to go to Tokyo. Okay, well, that's great. I'm glad that you had to do it, but did you want to do it? Did anyone tell you why it mattered? Not really. They just said I had to do it if I wanted to go to Tokyo. So that's the problem. No one's enrolled in it. So we need to actually share with people the why, because that's how people adopt new practices, is they actually get the why behind it.
That's Simon Sinek is infamous for a lot of things, especially his rant about the millennials. I think they call it the rant that broke the internet.
Right.
We've got so many amazing nuggets in that talk. But the why, so many organizations, and I'm going through the process right now, okay, doing a whole bunch of clinics, but also practice evaluations. And I'll say to the coach, did you tell them why you're doing the drill? And they go, because if you don't give them a why, this generation particularly, Gen Zers, digital natives, they want the why, because if you don't give it to them, what do? They go to Google. They go to YouTube and they figure it out.
Yeah.
But that why is the driving force. And we're all kind of in this space of trying to prevent this. But why are we trying to prevent this?
Exactly.
A lot of people don't want to have these conversations that at times need to happen. But I'll circle back on the respect group and the online training that used to be offered in clinics face-to-face.
Right. So
hockey clinics used to be, and the people that were facilitating them would share some of the anecdotes as to why we got to make sure there's a rule too, because you don't want this to happen.
Right.
So you think that'll ever, you touched on it early on, is one thing to have the education, but if you're not actually having people that are live delivery, is it going to change? I'll just kind of leave that before we wrap up.
Yeah. I think it's not enough. I think it's a two-prong approach. I think we need that modules. We need the online training so we can hit the masses.
Yeah.
And then I think as an organization, you need to know that it's more complex and you need to dig into what else is needed. And like I said, I mean, this is why I do what I do. And I have the experiential expertise is like, just, you need to go to how would I actually feel if I was in that environment? We have blinders on as humans. I have parents come to me and say, it's not fair that I can't be in my daughter's dressing room because she needs her skates tied. And I say, great. What if that person standing next to you was a pedophile? Do you still have the same feeling, right? We see it this way. I have coaches come to me and say, but Allison, I only put female coaches in hotel rooms with female athletes. And then I am who I am. And I say, how did that work out for the Catholic Church? So like, we need to get rid of our biases around gender. We need to get rid of our biases around I'm not a bad person and therefore no one else is. Because that's not true. So I think that's critical as well, is to just, it's never going to be enough until we all know that we have to let go of how we were conditioned and what we think is true. and actually look at the evidence of the Kyle Beaches and the hundreds of other hockey players that are right now waiting in the wing for their turn to do an interview, right? You need to be mindful of the people that I take phone calls from as like an athlete mentor. I know because I experienced it, and I know because I talk, people come call me. So that's the reality of it, is it happens, it sucks, and we have to let go of what's going to be hard for us to do, why we don't think it's going to happen because it never happened to us. You're lucky, but that's the key, right? It's not about us. It's about everyone else, right? I would say, I would like to say 100% of national sporting organizations, the people in the seat of the decision maker would never do this, never cover it up. And what I say to that person is, you also have never been trained to deal with this. Why do you want to deal with this in the first place? Right?
Yeah. And it's one of these things that you got to set the checks and balance in place so ultimately you can avoid it from happening to begin with.
Yeah.
So that we don't have to have those conversations after the fact.
It should be exactly before the fact. We need to get, the only way I can put it is we need to get upstream. And prevention is not prevention is not just online training. It's a culture shift where every second you're aware, you're watching. If you see something, you say something. You are an advocate. You don't, it's not okay if you hear an athlete say a bullying comment to another athlete, yeah. Right? You know, I do this with my kids every day. My kids are not the kids that would probably start it, but they're also not the kids that would stand up and say no once it started. So, you know, we have to educate our children. There's a lot of bullying that goes on in dressing rooms. I do not actually think kids should be left alone in a dressing room by themselves for 10 minutes. But there's a lot of bullying that goes on in dressing rooms. There's a lot of, and our children need to know that it's actually cool to say something because they're in that cool stage, right? Like, it's cool to not, you don't have to scream it out, but it's cool. And you won't get in trouble if you walk out of that door and say, that didn't make me feel good. And I saw a kid say that to another kid. This is the culture that we need to harvest now.
Okay. I'm going to wrap it up on that last point you made about coaches in the dressing room. It's too often I've seen, and I've come to evaluations where coaches are getting their skates on, say in the hockey space or whatever the case may be, out of the dressing room, and they're letting all these kids, whether they're 10, 12, 14, 15, get dressed without any leadership. I immediately say, if you don't get two coaches in that dressing room, I'm going to have to stop practice, because they have to be supervised at all times. That whole point of the rule too is for that reason. Mm-hmm. Not only are you protecting yourself, but you're protecting the kids from all the stuff that is happening, because the hazing is one that just gets me, that is still around, and it's trickled down to younger age groups, but there's other forms of harassment. We can talk about it at length. I can't thank you enough for doing this, Chad.
No, you're welcome.
The insight that I reaped, I'm glad that we're moving the needle in the right direction. I'm glad the 800 number is coming. You know, anonymity reporting is coming, independent third party. The work that you're doing with your co-founder was amazing. When I came across it, like, I didn't even know that this was a thing. It's happening. It's finally happening. Because 3 years ago, we were at all these Safe Sports summits. Like, this is what we need. So when's it going to, you know, everything, you can't, Rome didn't get built in a day. Nothing like this is going to get happen. But I'm glad we're moving the needle in the right direction. Yeah. So people want to find out more about what you do, how you do it, how do they reach you?
So the easiest, honestly, if you go, our site is, we're just re-platforming it right now, but it's live. It's itpsport.ca. If you just fill out that contact us, it comes to me. I'll just be honest. I don't have a team of 25 people behind that form. We're committed to get back to you within 24 hours. So we're here to, you know, we also will just take a call confidentially if someone wants to know how to navigate the system that has nothing to do with us. We also will take inquiries. If someone needs support, we will refer out to victim services. Like, just, we're a great resource, and we, you know, we're not in this to sell anyone on anything, but if your organization needs support with awareness sessions, I do a lot of speaking, anything around your policies or code of conduct, we're very, very happy, very, very happy to help as well. So thanks for the opportunity. And I'll just say one thing to you, Glenn, is like, in the absence of leadership, lead. That's sort of one of my mantras. And I got stuck a little bit in waiting for other people to do it. And I think that you're someone like myself now. So thank you for your leadership in this space and really caring. Like what you just said about the dressing room, like that takes a lot of courage to see it for what it is, because there's a cultural conditioning where that would be seen okay and could go on for the next 25 years. So thank you for your leadership in this space.
Well, I'm trying.
You know, it's
the world is shifting. And the one thing as a last takeaway, it is getting better. It is getting better because of the education, because of all the campaigns, the mandatory things, the all the stuff we need to do. And I'll say to coaches in every clinic, how many of you are here because you want to be? Maybe a third of them put their hands up. At the end of the day, okay, how many of you are here that we're glad they're here? All their hands go up. And so the main reason you didn't have hands to go up this morning is because you had to be here.
Yeah.
And with a big shift is we want to make it want instead of need. Because when they want the education, it's going to really smooth the deal. So kudos to you and the amazing work you're doing. And thanks so much for being here today. And
me too.
Best of luck moving the needle faster than later. So
yeah, great job. Okay, take care. Bye. Thanks, bye.